ago, I went to Israel this fall. It was the first time I ever traveled there. And I had been very much looking forward to the trip. And I had wanted to go to Israel growing up because I was raised Jewish. And then when I became a devotee of Jesus, I wanted to go because of Jesus. And so finally, after all these years, I did. Because of the responsibilities I've had in this temple and in other places for so many years, Easter and Christmas and much of the New Testament has been central to both my own personal spiritual life and what I have been asked to do in sharing these teachings with others. I've told the stories of the life of Jesus so many times, on Christmas to children, on Easter, for retreats, and that I can see those streets. And to me, it has been all so alive from the very beginning of the birth of Christ through the crucifixion and the resurrection. And I had the word Jerusalem really powerful in my mind, naturally. I mean, the word Jerusalem has power for almost everyone. It's just one of those ancient words that evokes so much. And so this whole trip to me, I rarely said that I was going either to the Holy Land or to Israel. I always said I was going to Jerusalem. God played games with me, as some of you know, because I went to three different places on this trip, and I actually went to India for a few days to visit Tushti and Surendra because Tushti was really ill, and I had to fly in and out of Rome to get to Jerusalem. And my connections just got completely messed up. It was just a lesson in always buy traveler's insurance. This is my message from the pulpit today. Always buy travel insurance. I didn't. But what was happening to me was that this tour was starting in Jerusalem, and I was stuck in Rome. And it's impossible to imagine being stuck, but I was stuck. And I worked it all out, spent a lot of money to get myself to Jerusalem on time. And of all things, and this really, it became comical at this point, except I wasn't laughing. The battery on my watch began to wear out, but it didn't stop. It just slowed down just enough for me to miss the plane. It was still running, but all of a sudden I get to the gate and the plane is gone. And I'm frantically running around the airport, and then finally I find somebody who'll talk to me. He points to my watch. He says, well, the plane took off. And it's like I looked at it, and then he shows me his. There's not a clock in the airport, just by the way. And here it is. It's exactly slow enough. It slowed down in a two-hour period, a whole hour. At which point, I was still not cheerful, but I just accepted that God did not want me to be in Jerusalem, and that was that. And so I missed the first day of the trip, and by the time it was all worked out, it was just a little karmic grinding that I had to go through. But in any case, I did end up going, to Jerusalem and to every other place. And I was predisposed in a certain way, which I know is not really a good idea. We led pilgrimage tours to India over the course of 20 years, took hundreds of people. And I know that it's not a good idea to have expectations, but Doctor, heal thyself. I had to learn it myself. But I expected to have something that looked like reincarnational memories. How could I not? It was all so vivid to me. I'm not one who's given to visions or shifting time zones or seeing my own face in ancient dress or anything like that. But I expected there to be something, especially on the streets of Jerusalem. Nada, zero, nothing. There wasn't the slightest any sense of myself as myself in any incarnation being part of that world. Jerusalem itself for me was kind of a non-event for reasons that I will speak a little bit now, but more at Easter probably. The Sea of Galilee was vivid and glorious. So it was a glorious trip for me. Not in any way that I expected. But here's the part that was so interesting. It was so deeply, and the word I want to use is impersonal. It was, Jesus was very impersonal. I myself, in relation to it, was very impersonal. And don't misunderstand that word. Sometimes people think of impersonal as like cold. Not at all that, but just so far bigger than any capacity to identify any little bite of it, that the thought of my going in there and having my own experience of my own relationship or my own past lives, it just got washed away. Just got washed away right at the very beginning in this experience of, well, you know, in many ways, isn't this interesting? Oddly enough, I never actually thought of this until just this moment. It was very much like the first time I met Swami Kriyananda. My first experience of Swami Kriyananda, which was right over here at Stanford as it happened, a friend of mine had recommended him, had already met him. This was 1969. And Swami was living in San Francisco and teaching in the Bay Area, and a friend of mine, Lakshmi, who lives at Ananda Village still, had met him and recommended him. Her beautiful words, "I've met a true teacher, and I think you'll like him," she said. So I went to hear him speak, and I was already conscious of self-realization, but not of Master's path. And when he walked into the room, and the room was half the size of this one, and I was sitting in the last row of actually what were bleachers. It was in a tent outside a fraternity house. A row of bleachers like this. And Swami walked in through doors there and stood what would be in the middle of this room. And what happened was this enormous space opened up. Just this infinite space. And I was conscious. For the first time, it was the beginning of vocabulary that I've since understood, that what I had felt all my life, which was agonizing, was an enormous sense of confinement. And I didn't know then, I found vocabulary later. Of course, what I was confined by was my infinite self's identification with this little body, this little personality, all its experiences. And when people would talk to me as I was growing up, and I was a talented person with willpower, and it looked like I should be able to do something, but everything they wanted me to do, I just felt that at the end of it, I would be, and I didn't have the words, but this was the feeling, I would be just as confined as I felt there, you know, being a high school student or an elementary school student. And it was that essential confinement that was making life miserable for me. And then gradually I learned about the spiritual path before I met Swami and about God, consciousness, and so on. But it was all just words to me. But when Swami walked in the room, and this is how I've said to people later, he had no boundaries. And I don't mean that in the psychological sense. There was no edge to his consciousness. He walked into the room. I was in the last row. I was about as far away from him as I could be and still be in the same space. And he was as present right where I was as he was where he was standing. And I articulated it inside myself without speaking it. He has what I want. And what he had was freedom. Freedom from what we all think of as just normal life. But there's an anguishing monotony to this, and this sense of harrowing vulnerability. Because we are always clinging to this little thing, and it can be threatened so easily, just so easily. You know, we become very careless about the way we relate to each other, and we become very careless about the dependencies that we build. And we so require this person to treat me this way and that one to treat me this way and me to have this comfort or that comfort in my little house, my little bed, my little cushions, my little this. You know, just every little thing. And when any of those go out, we're so vulnerable. This sort of, at least I feel it, There's always this underlying fear, because no matter how we get it organized. But you see, the masters, they're afraid of nothing, because they're not confined or defined by anything. Now, we have these different dimensions of this story of the life of Christ. We're at the little baby stage. And the little baby stage is, so full of sweetness. And we celebrate it with children. And on Christmas Day, we'll have the angels and the shepherds. And the whole story is so touching to the heart. But that's not the story. The story isn't how tiny and little we can get, and how we can set up our little families and celebrate our little families and our little children, and how you love me and I love you and we have our little home and it's all just so. Swami said that Master remarked once, God eats people. And then Swami said he illustrated it like this, like that. Just showing you. I mean, this is like, picking up human beings, chewing them like that. I mean, that's not comforting. We don't want to be eaten ourselves, and we certainly don't want our loved ones to be gobbled up by God, do we? But that's also what this story is about. And this is the story of the Star of Bethlehem and the three wise men, who is the other side. We have these groups of visitors who come to see the baby Jesus, and some of them are the wise men. And the wise men get there by following the star. And my, in our modern ignorance, we've now sorted out which comet it was and when it came and which star. Nothing of that. The Star of the East. The East has always been the point of intuitive perception. The star is the star of Christ consciousness. And those wise men, who Master said were three of our own gurus, Sri Teshwar, Babaji, and Lahiri, came to unite their consciousness with the consciousness that was already present. When you take a physical birth, you start as a baby. It's the way it works. But Master writes in Autobiography of a Yogi what his consciousness was as a baby. He was simultaneously consciousness of infinity. Swamiji writes about how from childhood, his earliest memories, he would go to sleep at night by seeing this great light in front of him. And that light would expand until it enveloped him and he would merge into it. And that was how he would go to sleep. He didn't know that everyone else didn't do that. He just thought that's what you did. Here I am in a child's body, but not really. And so Jesus, sweet and heart-touching as it is, and I'll speak in a moment about that part of it, but he was the infinite spirit. And these great masters came from India, from Tibet. I mean, did they travel over actual space, or did they materialize in the moment there? There's, contradictions about Sri Yukteswar being John the Baptist, and were they incarnated at the same time? Swami just goes like this, a master can do anything. Just waves his hand. But the point is, we're not dealing with anything small. And what's being asked of us is not small. What is being asked of us is infinite in scope. And sitting there as I was in the Mount of Transfiguration and on the Sea of Galilee and at Capernaum, and it's both amusing and appalling. I really could never decide which way to think about it. All the buildings that have had to be built over all the places where Jesus lived, because in all these hundreds of years, people keep and necessarily wanting to memorialize and wanting to organize it. I mean, we ourselves are in a beautiful big building, and many things can happen because we have a structure in which we can gather. And I never walk in this building ever without gratitude to God for just giving us a place. But at Capernaum especially, there's the house where Let's see, whose house would it have been? Maybe it was Peter's house. The details were always obscure to me. It might have been Peter's house there. And they wanted, you know, and everything, because it was so long ago, it's all way underground, because things, so they've excavated it down. But they've built this humongous church on top of it. But it's sort of shaped like a UFO at the bottom. But the whole thing is like elevated just slightly above Peter's house. So you go outside and you're standing there at this gate and you're looking down into Peter's house, but right over it, hovering literally like a giant flying saucer, is this strange struts of this gigantic building that's over it. So it's really like this is where Jesus was, and this huge thing just rests like this. You actually can't get into it, but it's right there and you're peering in like this with this massive structure. And well, the symbology is too obvious, but not just of churchianity versus the real teachings of Jesus, but the freedom that Jesus brought us and what that freedom really is, and whether or not we're going to take little bits of it or whether we're going to take it all. And the Christmas carol that you sang this morning, Christmas Mystery, how a tiny babe in a manger laid. And then the word, Swami, so brilliant with this poetry. Could so many hearts to love persuade? Of course, Swami always writes about the challenge of having to write poetry to melody. In most of his songs, melody comes first, and then the words will follow. But it usually follows all very easily. But just that phrase, to love persuade, you would think, why would we have to be persuaded? I mean, the one thing most profoundly, seemingly, that everyone is seeking is to be loved, to be understood. Swamiji writes in his book, Love Perfected, Life Divine. Well, actually, it's not written in there. It was written by me on the back cover of the book, in fact. But it was Swami's words that he spoke, just speaking about how deeply every one of us longs to be loved. And he says, loved for yourself, not loved abstractly. Now that book is about soulmates, which is a wholly different conversation. But Swami puts this phrase, he said this phrase, every desire given to us must be fulfilled. And that deep desire to be loved is given to us by God, and therefore God must intend to fulfill it. Now we practice that with each other. We practice it in our romances, we practice it with our children, with our siblings. We practice. And I say we practice in the sense is we learn what love can feel like. We learn what the joy is of just giving yourself completely, of being completely unafraid. And here we come to that fear again, completely unconfined by all of our worries and our expectations and our countless past life disappointments. And we have to be persuaded. We have to be persuaded time and time again to risk, don't we? But what we're really trying to be persuaded to is not a deeper and deeper involvement in, well, it didn't work out with you, and now it'll work out with you, and those children were kind of a disappointment, but you're going to be the son who really fulfills my dreams. You know, just it goes on and on and on like that. But the love we're really trying to be persuaded to is that which is inherent within us. And to be persuaded that all that we're seeking, even with one another, we find it through one another, but not from one another. And even the love that we give, it's not mine. It's through me. I lived all those years with Swami Kriyananda. And what came through him? You know, it's hard to define. How do you define someone's greatness? You can talk about a personality, and he was charming, and he was funny, and he was brilliant, and all those things. But really what it was what came through him. And what came through him was this constancy of love for everyone. Just constancy, it never wavered. You know, I remember once when he was particularly exasperated with his own gurubais, who caused him so much trouble. Practically the worst I ever heard him say was, "If I weren't more evolved, I would bop her one," is what he said one day. Meaning, you know, the temptation is there. But what would that serve me? And how would it serve those that I love? And so what came through him was just this constancy. And the only way that you can have that constancy is if you are inwardly connected. If you have gone away from all of this, into the spiritual eye, that's how that tiny babe could persuade so many hearts to love. Because even just lying there, even from his slumber flows peace. That's another line in one of Swami's songs. But what came through him? What came through that baby? And as that baby grew into the magnificent man that he became, what came through him was this constancy of the awareness of the divine in all. And this celebration of Christmas with the baby Jesus is because we're less afraid to love a baby. But what we have from that, you see, is the experience of the freedom to love. And then what we become deeply persuaded to is that freedom to love is really who I want to be. And then we practice. We practice on each other. Our husbands, our wives, our fathers, our mothers, our sons and daughters, brothers and sisters and friends. We practice being persuaded always to love. Oh, what should be done here? Now bear in mind, that love is powerful. It's not, oh, let's make everyone happy. You know, the constancy of that love often makes people quite unhappy, quite profoundly unhappy. Because if we're determined to live in confinement, God is more determined to break our chains. And that's real love. You know, the mother who spoils her child in the name of love, that's not love, that's selfishness. The mother who raises a giant with all the power potential within him to express, that's real love. That's the love that God is persuading us to. That's the love that little baby is persuading him to. So on one hand, it's deeply impersonal. But on the other hand, we learn infinity in the smallness of each moment. And loving that little baby Jesus in all his glory with our whole hearts is the beginning of our becoming like him. And for this reason and for this reason alone, do we live? Were we born? And do we live? God bless you.